The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. It's a story that could have been ripped from the pages of a political thriller. The anti-establishment American presidential candidate, a British data firm run by an old Etonian, a Cambridge professor gone rogue, dark arts and propaganda, and then an election win and a referendum that changes the course of history. As the political world gets to grips with the Cambridge Analytica story, we'll hear from the journalist who broke it open.
For a long time, we didn't think we were going to be able to get this story out, so it's incredibly just such a relief that we have.
The whistleblower.
We wouldn't just be targeting you as a voter, we'd be targeting you as a personality.
And one of the UK politicians trying to get answers.
Why was it that Facebook knew about this data breach for 2 years and did nothing about it?
So, how is big data changing elections? And how should it be regulated? Also this week, as the EU Council meets to sign off Britain's transition deal, we'll hear why some key areas are still only penciled in. And a president who rules by decree, untroubled by the ballot box. Why did Jean-Claude Juncker congratulate Vladimir Putin? But first, it's a complex story that The Observer and Guardian have been covering since 2015. A data analytics firm that worked on the winning election campaign of Donald Trump was involved in one of Facebook's biggest ever data breaches. Here's how it worked. A Cambridge University professor named Alexander Cogan legitimately accessed data from the profiles of 50 million American voters for research. He was looking into whether you could deduce personality and political leanings from Facebook profiles. By getting people to take a short personality quiz, he also got them to give permission to use not only their Facebook data, but that of all their friends. He then passed on the data to Cambridge Analytica, and this week a former employee turned whistleblower went public.
My name is Christopher Wiley. I'm a data scientist, and I helped set up Cambridge Analytica.
He described how his boss, Alexander Nix, the company's now departed CEO, sold themselves to Steve Bannon, the man who went on to become Donald Trump's chief strategist.
Alexander Nix is with me, and he starts with this sort of like razzle dazzle.
We work for the Pentagon, we work for, you know, MOD, MI6, da 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 da. We are brilliant and Eton and whatnot, and I'm a posh British man, and you should trust me with all of your money.
Essentially, the pitch was that we were going to combine micro targeting, which had existed in politics, which was, you know, in part my background, but bring on boards new constructs from psychology so that we wouldn't just be targeting you as a voter, we'd be targeting you as a personality. And in order to scale that, we would then be collecting a lot of data on people so that we could build a psychological profile of each voter in a particular region, or in this case, all of the United States.
Now, back in February, Alexander Nix was called before the House of Commons Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee to give evidence, and he had this to say.
We don't work with Facebook data. We don't have Facebook data. We do use Facebook as a platform to advertise, as do all brands and most agencies. And we use Facebook as a means to gather data. So we roll out surveys on Facebook that the public can engage with if they elect to.
But that, it seems, was not the full story. Conservative MP Damian Collins is the chair of that committee and is calling for Nix to reappear. But he also wants answers from Facebook itself. I spoke to him this week and I started by asking whether Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg had responded to his request to appear in front of the committee.
We've not had a response yet. But I think it's really important that he does speak out and put himself in a position where he has to answer questions. Too often he hides behind, you know, posts on his Facebook page or, you know, pre-recorded statements. He has to lead this company and reassure millions and millions of Facebook users around the world who are really concerned that their data is not safe with that company.
And is there anything you as a committee can do to compel him to appear in front of you?
No, because he's an American citizen and is based in America, we can only compel British citizens and people who live in the UK. So we can't compel him to come. But I think there is a growing clamour for him to put himself forward and be subject to questioning. The United States Congress have made a similar request, and I think that's what he should do.
And on another CEO, Alexander Nix, the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, you have suggested that he misled your committee. Can you explain why you said that?
Yeah, we asked him straight whether he had acquired data from Alexander Kogan, the academic at Cambridge University, to support the work of Cambridge Analytica. He said that they hadn't, and I think it's clear from the evidence that's been presented so far that they did. And you know, we need Alexander Nix and Cambridge Analytica to be able to answer why his evidence is such a, at such clear odds with what we now know. And if we feel that he's misled us and misled Parliament, then we will report that to the House.
You sound quite calm about it now, but I've seen you at other times sounding really quite angry about it.
Well, I think it's really clear. I think it was quite brazen what he was doing, and he was seeking to play down the significance of what had happened and probably thought we'd never find out the truth. But now that evidence has come out, and it's not just about Alexander Nix and Cambridge Analytica, but also why was it that Facebook knew about this data breach for 2 years and did nothing about it? Well, certainly nothing to actively recover the data. They only sought to do that when The Guardian told them it was going to publish.
And to what extent should people be concerned about just the 2017 election in this country? I mean, do you think that your own party, the Labour Party, others have gone too far in targeting individuals as a way of political campaigning?
I think there's a, when political parties do it, they do it in the way they campaign in the streets as well. It's clear who the message is coming from. Users can see whether it's the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, they accept or reject it on that basis, or you know, they may be interested. But what about when you're getting messaging that comes from what looks like a Facebook page based around an issue you care about, but actually that organisation is not really a local campaign group. It's a political organisation that you don't know about, may not even be in this country, and is seeking to influence the way you vote and think. And the concern people have about social media and the way it works is that actually it pushes people to more extreme content. If you've liked and engaged with some sort of content, it recommends more of the same, and sometimes more that's even more extreme. You see that on the way the Facebook news feed works, and also how the Next Up feature works on YouTube. And so there is this concern about whether mass political communications through social media is actually driving the driving politics to the extremes.
So when Carol Cadwalader wrote the first big story on this, it was named the Great Brexit Robbery, and it was all about the Leave campaign. I was just looking back at that story today, and I noticed that it had 198,000 shares. That's people actually publishing the article in one form or another. It clearly caused a huge interest. Partly that's because it's such a divisive issue, but do you believe that Cambridge Analytica were involved in the Leave campaign?
I don't know, is the honest question. They've denied being involved. We know that they were in conversations with Leave.eu and would have worked with Leave.eu on the campaign if they'd been designated as the official campaign. I don't know whether they worked with other campaign groups, but it's whatever Cambridge Analytica did, I think it's clear that the same data analytics tools and voter profiling techniques were used, and social media was used to try and target voters and sway their opinion. And I think many people would look at some of the, you know, more extreme images and messages during that campaign, particularly around immigration, and be concerned, well, actually, was social media being used to make people frightened about things that weren't actually, you know, reflective of the truth?
Damian Collins there. Well, I'm now joined in the studio by my panel, The Observer's Carol Cadwalader, who has been on this story for the past 3 years, The Guardian's tech reporter, Alex Hearn, and Steve Howell, who was Deputy Director of Strategy and Communications for Labour during the 2017 election, and whose book about his experience, Game Changer, 8 Weeks That Transformed British Politics, is out shortly. Carol, I've got to start by asking you, where did this all begin? Can you take us back to when you first stumbled or came across this and just explain to us how you made it evolve from there?
So it was actually just very shortly after Trump's election, and I just started looking at kind of fake news, and I stumbled across these, I did a story about Google and these weird Google results, how the you know, I was typing in things like "Are Jews" into Google search engine and getting these results that "Are Jews evil" was the suggestion that Google was giving me, and then like all these anti-Semitic sites. And I came across this academic in America called Jonathan Albright. And we had this like late night freak out conversation when we were both kind of swapping what we were finding. And he was the first person. He told me about this company called Cambridge Analytica. And I put that in that first piece. And I sort of said they worked for the Trump campaign. They worked for Leave in the referendum. And that piece was published. And we had all this kind of, you know, blowback from Google. But I also started getting letters from Cambridge Analytica saying we never worked for the Leave campaign. So we just, Stephen, who is the reader's editor, just wrote back, kept on writing back and sort of saying, well, here's where your CEO said you worked for the Leave campaign and here's where leave.eu said you worked for them. So what's your problem? And they kept on writing. And eventually I was like, OK, this is something very weird going on here. What's going on? And then as a result of that, I went and chatted to Andy Wigmore of the leave.eu. And I did my first piece on Cambridge Analytica and Robert Mercer and leave.eu and Nigel Farage and all these weird links back in February last year, so a long time ago. And then it's just evolved from there. I started tracking down ex-employees, and a couple of months later, I was told there was this ex-employee I found, and he said, you need to find Christopher Wiley. And so I did. I went and found him. and then he started talking, and then he just really hasn't stopped talking since.
And you've faced some huge legal pressures along the way. I mean, how have Cambridge Analytica dealt with the spotlight you've brought up on them?
It has been an extremely, extremely, extremely difficult year. And because we brought out, Chris became a source, an anonymous source for this article I wrote in May called The Great Brexit Robbery. And we published that. And then we got our first threatened letter from Cambridge Analytica. And it's very serious, you know. They were threatening to sue us in America for special damages. And that's the type of thing which makes managing editors and editors get very, very nervous. So it's been, you know, and then we got a second one a week later, and we continued to publish. It has to be said, like, great Paul Webster, the Observer editor, really showed steel. We got a letter to sue us on one Saturday morning the week later, and then we published, you know, a big story and published a document that evening. And then it died down for a bit. But then in September, we got another one. And that was, we all thought that was it. I wasn't going to be out. You know, I've been trying to get out Chris the whistleblower. And when we got that one, we thought, oh, no, it's never going to happen now. And we really, you know, had to, Jill, the Observer's, the Guardian and Observer's head of legal, put an enormous amount of work into our response to them. It was something like a 45-page legal letter we sent back. So it has been, and then the other thing we had, which was that Chris had a non-disclosure agreement that he had to break to go on the record. And so that's been a huge thing because he's had to show massive public interest. I had to find him a lawyer. We had to find, you know, resources. So it's, you know, for a long time, we didn't think we were going to be able to get this story out. So it's incredibly just such a relief that we have.
And it's worth saying that actually just about a week before this revelation blew up, you won Specialist of the Year for last year's reportage. Can you just tell our listeners what you exposed last week and how significant it is?
We always knew, I mean, that there were these massive revelations about Cambridge Analytica and what they'd done. And we could see how they had lied all over the place. And we had evidence that they'd lied. And we had evidence that Alexander Nix had lied to MPs in a select parliamentary committee. And we also had this evidence about Facebook and their refusal. That 50, upwards of 50 million people's profiles had been harvested off Facebook. And then that information had been used to target them politically by the company that had worked on Trump's campaign. But what we didn't realise, I have to say, and took us by surprise, was that the lengths that Facebook went to last week to shut this story down, and they slapped in this threat on Friday, the day before publication. You know, that has blown up so spectacularly in Facebook's face, as you know, and that's been the sort of very unexpected thing, really, just like quite what an impact it's had on them. So.
It does make, if I could jump in, it does make the apology given today by Zuckerberg look a bit pathetic, the fact that they obviously did so much to try and stop the story. What you wonder in these situations, though, because I've had quite a few of them over the years dealing with cases on behalf of clients, is...
In your PR world as opposed to in your labour world.
Yeah, for about 20 years I've run a communications consultancy. And we, you know, a lot of our clients have made a stand on things. and I can't go into details, but you know, they've made a stand on an issue, and then they've come up against a much more powerful adversary. And sometimes what happens in these situations, I know from direct experience, is someone senior but not right at the top of the organization takes a very hard line and you know, threatens to sue you and really kind of goes the whole hog. And then when it reaches the top of the organization, someone who's a bit more savvy and has got a broader perspective suddenly decides, hang on, there's a massive reputational risk to us here. Do we really want to get as heavy-handed as this? Now, I'm not saying that's the case in the case of Zuckerberg, but do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I have to say it was quite something to watch him come out and grovel this morning. I mean, Alex, we can talk about Facebook in a moment, but just on Cambridge Analytica, I mean, they are clearly masters of self-promotion, as the humiliating undercover footage showed earlier this week. But are they selling something that provably works?
Well, I mean, this is the big question. It's hard for me to know. It's hard for anyone to know with regards to Cambridge Analytica because they are so opaque. My gut feeling is that they are as much spin men as they are masters of persuasion, if for no other reason than, well, if you're the sort of person who gets caught on a secret camera talking about how you catch people on secret cameras, it's hard to think of you as a magician, right? But beyond that, there's some Occam's razor stuff that I would go into here. When you have companies like Amazon, companies like Facebook themselves, actually, these enormous multi-billion dollar ad spends, they don't really go in for this psychometric profiling. They go much simpler things. If you nearly bought something, you're probably going to buy that. And Amazon gets to try all these approaches millions of times a day. Political parties get one attempt every 4 years to try a new approach. They have fundamentally just much, much less data to go on whether these things work, and a much bigger goal for going for these big, perhaps snake oil salesmen who promise without quite enough evidence that they can radically change things. And I feel that might be what happened here. If Cambridge Analytica really had the stuff they were saying they would sell, they could have made a lot more money moving out of politics into conventional advertising, right?
It's probably a different show, but I've often wondered about these Amazon advertising. They always seem to advertise things that I've already bought.
I know.
I don't understand it.
It's the masters of AI, right?
Can I jump in there?
Yes.
Because I think there's this kind of there's a sort of tech bro argument which goes down in, and I'm not at all saying that's what you're doing here, Alex. But one of the sort of frustrations in this story has been that the sort of spin of the sort of snake oil salesman, I think does obscure actual hard science, which is also going on. You don't hire kind of PhDs from Harvard and Cambridge to get them to sit there to you know, flog a kind of secondhand car. And there was serious investment which went into this company. And it operates very different from any other sort of campaign data analytics firm, because it's more like DARPA for elections. You know, it's ongoing research, which has got nothing to do with the candidate you're supporting at that time. It's, you know, most of these companies, they work for a candidate and then it's like an off season or whatever. Whereas they were just, they invested in the technology and were refining it. And I do think you must remember that it's owned by Robert Mercer, who is like an app, you know, he's one of the pioneers of AI and who invented algorithmic trading. Maybe I give them too much of the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, I can see how all this other ropey stuff, you know, which was there existing in the firm beforehand. But I think I'd be very careful just to dismiss the kind of the science out of hand.
I'm just going to come to you in a minute, Steve. But just on that point, Carol, is it possible that it's very different in different parts of the world? I was talking to someone who was involved in the Kenya campaign that Cambridge Analytica have been linked to, who did describe it as essentially snake oil salesman, because in fact you didn't have the data within Kenya. The usage of the internet was much lower than it is in other parts of the world, but presumably in America there is a lot you can do. I remember going to a conference where they said Cambridge Analytica knows more about you than you know about yourself. I mean,
I don't think it is that low in Kenya. I mean, I've been in Kenya where the Maasai tribesmen coming, they're all on Facebook. I mean, the mobile is lesser. I mean, it leapt to technology, didn't it, in Africa? It went straight from, they didn't bother with landlines, and they went straight to mobile. I mean, the other thing is that you've got to remember, this is a company with 30 years mastery in disinformation and propaganda and rumor campaigns. And so I think you've just got to be very careful to take any of these things at face value. And I, you know, I certainly know that there's a lot more to come out about Kenya. They've worked in Kenya for a very long time. And you've got to remember, and, you know, they were using even before they got into data, there was a set of techniques they used, which were used by militaries all over the world. So if these techniques don't work, well, then that's also, you know, that they don't work, that the millions of pounds which the British government has spent on doing that kind of thing in Afghanistan, the millions of dollars that the American government has.
Can I jump in on that point and just say that I think Carol is right in that I don't think you should underestimate the ability to kind of influence people through these means. But it is also the case that they were, and I mean, maybe this is part of their approach, but, you know, they were pushing at an open door in the sense that you didn't have to be kind of a political genius to know that Hillary Clinton's problem was in the Midwest states. That had been obvious for 18 months from throughout the Sanders campaign. She wasn't winning the Midwest states. She was having severe difficulty. And so in that sense, politically, they were pushing at an open door. So whilst there's a degree to which, you know, this manipulation can take place, you have to have the raw material for it. You have to have people who are receptive to it.
Can I ask you about that? Because on the one hand, there's clearly a massive scandal that Carol and others have uncovered here. And, you know, some of the techniques they've used are very dark, exploiting people's fears, etc. On the other hand, loads of political parties all over the world, including the Labour Party, Steve, use targeting in a very detailed way. Now, you know, you were in a very senior position in 2017. We're going to be reading all about it in your book that's coming out. Just tell us how you use targeting and how important it was to you. And are the other companies that you've come across quite different to Cambridge Analytica?
Well, we didn't, during the campaign anyway, work with a company like Cambridge Analytica. In fact, we hardly used any external support at all. We had a couple of freelance communications consultants, and we had a creative agency doing some design work. There had been some work done by the data team in the elections department at Labour head office that had tapped into Experian, and this is all in the public domain.
And you spent a lot of money on Facebook as well.
Well, that was a very late on in the campaign. Just to explain, I mean, the bulk of what we did on social media was organic. And it arose from the fact that, you know, Jeremy's got a very big following on Twitter and Facebook. And over the 2 years of his leadership, he had been, or the team around him had been, very successful in building that profile, you know, creating a lot of great content, as well as a lot of people, a sort of a wider support network of people who were doing a lot of activity on Facebook and Twitter, who were also generating a lot of great content as well. So for the first 6 weeks of the campaign, 5 or 6 weeks of the campaign, we were reliant very largely on organic activity, Jeremy's feeds, wider supporters, the Labour Party's own feeds. All of this activity, they saw a great growth in what you would call our reach on social media. We saw it grow from about 2 to 4 or 5 million. The spending element of it came in only once we started to get much more money coming in online from our supporters. We raised £4 million online in small donations from supporters. And also some money came in, a large amount of money came in from Unite, that gave us the budget that allowed us, as the campaign progressed, and particularly in the last 2 weeks or so, to actually start spending money on advertising on social media. And we spent, let's say digital, we spent £1.2 million altogether. Just over 400,000 of that was actually on Facebook advertising. We also did quite a lot of stuff on Google AdWords. We did we did advertising on YouTube and so on. Well, the difficulty with all these things is measuring it, but the point of it was to get to reach into areas that our organic reach wasn't getting to. Jeremy's following on Twitter is very big, but it's skewed towards young people. There's a higher proportion of younger people who follow him on Twitter. We wanted to get into, you know, older age profiles. We wanted to get into specific geographical areas where we, you know, we were targeting offensive seats. And on Facebook and, you know, other social media, you can be quite specific about what you're targeting, you, geographically, demographically, and so on. So the paid for element allowed us to complement the organic stuff and reach into areas that we didn't think we were reaching sufficiently organically.
Okay.
And I think that did make a difference. But we had already, by that stage of the campaign, seen a surge in our support. So I think the bigger factor was our organic activity. But undoubtedly, that targeting into certain areas, you know, is a important thing to be able to do.
One thing that's been quite extraordinary about all this is watching you on social media fight off some pretty aggressive individuals from certain organisations. We probably can't name them all legally, but how's it been for you personally? I mean, I feel like you've really had to dig in and keep fighting. Have there been times you've wanted to give up on this?
I've never wanted to give up, but it has just been like being trapped on a kind of like out of control freight train, essentially. I'm a features writer. This was not intentional. And I stumbled across this and I've just been kind of clinging on for dear life. And I've just had this huge commitment to this, you know, this whistleblower who wanted to get his story out, and I had, you know, needed to help him.
Are you good mates now?
He's amazing. He is like a master of information warfare. he's endlessly entertaining and interesting to talk to. So in that sense, it has been, you know, it's been an absolute pleasure and a joy. But it has been a really, really, really difficult year. I was never on social media. I always hated it. And then I never didn't want any part of it. I'm kind of a very private person. And I took to Twitter, having never used it before, because I just sort of realised that I needed to drive support for this story. And it's been really valuable in that sense. And it really has helped to grow the story. And I've actually taken a lot of support from people who have really kind of also, you know, really followed the story and sort of helped me along in that sense. And that has been really kind of,
I noticed you had 20,000 extra followers in about 3 hours the other day. And just on that, do you think being a feature writer rather than being perhaps an expert in these areas has in some ways helped you to continue with the story?
I think it's really interesting because I think it's the human angle. I mean, it's the human angle of technology that I've always been interested in, and it's the human angle of the stories that's the thing which, you know, fascinates me. And I think it has sort of given me a different perspective on things. And I think there's somebody who I met very early on, because this woman who's kind of quite inspirational to me, she's called Claire Rucastle Brown. She runs the Sarawak blog, and she uncovered this sort of biggest financial scandal in history. And I met her very early on in this, and I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not an investigative reporter, and yet I'm supposed to be investigating this thing. And she sort of said, oh, don't worry about it. She said, well, there's a lot of journalists out there. Most of the men, they're very obsessed with documents and data dumps and things like that. And she said, I always find the best stories come from people. And it's just really helped me, actually, because I said to her, you know, I'm not an investigative reporter. I've got as far as I have just by chatting to people. And that's the thing which has sort of carried me on, actually. I was like, I'll actually, chatting to people, it turns out, is a kind of key skill. And it's the only one I've really got. So there we go.
So Carol's been talking to people, you know, about data. And let's be honest, people have been talking about Cambridge Analytica for some time. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to us what changed? What has led us to a new level where you've got Mark Zuckerberg grovelling on TV?
So the big thing here, and it's also the thing that distinguishes Cambridge Analytica from, frankly, something like the Obama campaign, which in many ways did very similar things. Both the Obama campaign and Cambridge Analytica's partner, the company run by Alexander Kogan, used a setting which was available in Facebook until 2015, which basically let you give permission for an application developer to see all of the information your friends had on Facebook, which is, you know, you already say that and you go, that's kind of dodgy. Facebook had
kind of right.
Facebook had perhaps good reasons for introducing it. When they began it, their description was, for instance, if you build a calendar app, you want to be able to see which of your friends' birthdays it is on any given day. Fine, but a lot more data made it out that way. The big distinction between the Obama campaign and what Cambridge Analytica was involved in is the Obama campaign, very straightforwardly, went to Obama supporters and said pretty much, hey, we're the Obama campaign. Support us by giving us your data and giving us your friends' data as well. And the Obama supporters went, yeah, cool. I want Obama to be elected. Cambridge Analytica wasn't so open. Cambridge Analytica's partner, Corgan's company, said, hey, do some tests, some psychological evaluations. We'll pay you $1 on Amazon's Mechanical Turk service if you fill in this psychological evaluation and give us access to you and your friends' data. They collected the 50 million profiles that way, and then Cambridge Analytica got access to it. The exact nature, I think, of that transaction is still disputed.
Well, Corgan says he's been scapegoated.
Right. So Corgan says, I was just doing legitimate psychological research. But Cambridge Analytica got hold of that data somehow, and it's
And he said he didn't make any money off it?
Right, exactly. So it's
that true?
I don't know. I mean, like I say, there is a dispute at the heart of this. But for Facebook, that doesn't really matter. What matters for them is that a company collected data for one purpose, psychological evaluation, which was then used for another purpose, targeting adverts in an election. That's bad enough already, because that's not how data protection law should work. There's no first sale doctrine. If you collect data, you're responsible for it. Compounding the issue is the fact that in 2015, a Guardian reporter, Harry Davies, reported this. He said Cambridge Analytica and the Ted Cruz campaign, as they were then working on, are using data harvested from 50 million profiles.
Story was back then.
So in 2015, Facebook wrote to Cambridge Analytica and Alexander Corgan and said, please delete this data. That is the thing that's got them in so much trouble this time. That's what allowed Carol on Saturday, to say, it took them 2 years and they did nothing. 4 days after we dropped them an approach, they blocked Cambridge Analytica. They've known all this time. All they did back in 2015 was send a letter out and going, please delete the data and tell us you have. That's it. No further examination, no further audits, just please tell us. That just utter failure to get on top of the story first time round is the real reason why Zuckerberg is out there now.
And Steve, you've kind of seen this from a couple of sides, a couple of points of view, shall we say. And one thing I'm really interested in is that difference between you, the Labour Party, telling people that you are targeting them and being very open about who you are, or, you know, perhaps shadowy organisations that we're not so clear about, perhaps based abroad, who are essentially trying to exploit your fears. Do you think there is a clear line between those things, or do you think this is an area in which everyone has to be much more careful?
Well, I think both. There is a clear line between these things, and there should be going forward. I mean, I was staggered when I read that it had been allowed that these adverts could be unattributable and untrackable. I wonder whether that's part of the boastful claims that they were making or whether it's entirely true. But certainly all the things that we were doing on social media, it was very clear who was doing them, whether it was Jeremy Corbyn's, one of his posts on Twitter, or a Labour Party post, or indeed any one of the supporters who were doing their own thing, but obviously complimentary. So I think, I mean, in terms of what happens going forward on this, I think there are some things that are relatively easy to fix. You know, there should be a kind of advertising standards for social media. And one of those standards should be that they should absolutely clearly label who is paying for the advert, and that to be very transparent.
This is a feature that Facebook has committed to introducing before the 2018 midterms in the US. It is absolutely the case in the platform as it stands right now that you can pay for an advert. You don't have to put your name to it. You don't have to say who you are. It's certainly not tied into, in the US electoral law. You just pay to promote a thing. Part of the problem with Facebook's proposed approach is that the only real thing that they're saying you have to do is link it back to a public page or group. There is not yet any Facebook enforcement or US electoral law which says that public page or group has to then disclose the real name behind it. So we're just going to shift it all up a level, which is great.
Those things can be fixed as we go along, as long as there's a will to fix it. I think the important thing is that in the course of this, we don't tie social media up in so many knots that it doesn't do the positive things that social media has done in terms of giving people an opportunity to share things, whether it be on a personal level or, you know, politically. And like I say, most of what we did, the Labour Party did on social media, was done organically, and it was people wanting to share content because they supported it and they agreed with it, and it was good, lively, interesting content. And you don't want, I think advertising is one thing, and what people post as individuals or even as campaign groups who are posting it on a voluntary basis, if you like, not as paid for advertising, and that's done transparently. You know, there should be a clear distinction between the two, and that should be clear to users of social media. They should be able to see, you know, understand what they're looking at, whether it's something that's paid for or whether it's something that's posted voluntarily.
And interestingly, before the 2017 election, large tech companies were telling us that organic shares didn't matter. It was only who you targeted. They were wrong there. Now, just to finish us off, Alex, Steve has made the point there that there is a huge positive to social media, but we're also now seeing this huge negative. Just tell us, can the genie be put back in the bottle?
I think it can be. The thing to remember is that really when we talk about social media, we mean Facebook. We mean one company which is centrally run by a man who holds 60% of the voting rights on his board.
You say that, but I was with a load of sixth formers today and all of them told me they're not on Facebook.
I know, but they are all on Instagram, which is owned by Facebook.
They're on Snapchat.
Right, so Snapchat is one of the big exceptions here. But frankly, Snapchat's prospects are looking a lot shadier in the last year since Instagram has successfully disrupted it. You know, Snapchat is big, but it's not looking anymore like it might be that dagger that gets driven into Facebook's heart and ends its reign. And while it is Facebook and Instagram, all it really takes is the whim of one man to radically change this. Mark Zuckerberg woke up one day and went, you know what, actually, I don't want as much news on Facebook, and changed the algorithm. And there is less news on Facebook now. If Mark Zuckerberg decides tomorrow, oh God, just politics is just too much, let's just not have it, then Facebook could not have politics almost overnight. That would be another radical change. But given how little upside there has been for Facebook having politics to date for Mark Zuckerberg, it's not outrageous to think that he might just go, pictures, music, events, that's nice and harmless. Let's focus on that.
Well, blimey, that is a scary thought to finish on. Hopefully we can take some hope from the fact that Mark Zuckerberg, who is clearly one of the most powerful men in the world, at least woke up this morning and said, I'm going to apologise. Well, you can continue to follow The Guardian and Observer's reporting of this story, and there is plenty more to come at theguardian.com. Now, this week, Britain and the EU finally agreed on the transition deal that will kick into effect at the end of March next year, when the UK formally leaves the bloc. It will last until December the 31st, 2020, and after that, Brexit will be, in theory anyway, complete. Well, joining me on the line from Brussels is Heather Stewart. So, Heather, you're in Brussels. It's an EU council that we thought was going to be a very big deal, but maybe not as big a deal when it comes to Brexit and transition as we expected?
Yeah, I think that's right. So Donald Tusk made clear earlier in the week that the EU27 countries are going to accept this draft text of a transition deal, which we know officials on both sides have been working on for weeks. So Theresa May is going to come along today. In fact, she's already arrived and be told, yes, you've got the green light to go on to the next stage, to the really nitty-gritty bit of working out what our future relationship with our European partners will be.
But they've kicked a lot down the road.
They absolutely have. In particular, the issue of Northern Ireland and how to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland. That's something on which there's been a lot of tension. And really, there are still a number of options on the table, including this sort of fallback option, which Westminster, which Theresa May hates, which is this idea of you know, effectively not having any border at all. So it's quite problematic, that, and there is chat here about it having to be resolved within sort of 3 months or so. And certainly the clock really is ticking now, because you know, David Davis wants to have the broad outlines of the deal by sort of October, so that parliaments can vote on it and it can all be ratified. So it's in a way, it's the really nitty-gritty stuff that starts now.
Yeah, there will be a day, Heather, when we actually sit down and talk about their proposed solution for the Irish border, but we don't know when that day will be.
It has not yet come. No.
And in the meantime, the big story is the election of Vladimir Putin and Europe's reaction to that, not least because of what happened in Salisbury in the UK. There were a lot of raised eyebrows about President Juncker's response to Vladimir Putin with his letter of congratulations, and President Trump, of course, congratulating the president despite notes in front of him telling him not to. What is the UK's message going to be to the rest of the EU as it asks for solidarity?
Well, so when Theresa May arrived here, she did a little sort of broadcast clip when she arrived, and her message was very much about Russia and the way she sees its recent behaviour. She talked about Russia not respecting borders. She talked about a kind of pattern of behaviour. So this is not just a one-off event. It's a kind of a series of aggressions as she sees it. And she's looking for the strongest possible sort of solidarity and reinforcement of Britain's position. And in fact, you know, we were told, as we wrote this morning, that she is going to suggest to other countries that perhaps they might not like to echo what Britain has done and send home a few Russian diplomats.
What's the chance of any of them actually doing that? And do you think Brexit actually reduces our chance of getting a strong response from the rest of the EU?
Yeah, it's odd. I think Brexit kind of heightens Britain's desire to show that it's shoulder to shoulder with its European partners, and to say, you know, look, we're still a global country, we still want to operate, you know, cooperate on security just as strongly as we have in the past. But I think that to some extent it makes some of the other countries a little bit warier of you know, just kind of unthinkingly accepting Britain's position on some of these things. And certainly there have been some countries, so Greece, for example, has said today, you know, do we really have enough evidence to take action? And you know, so I think it may be a somewhat nuanced position from the other side, although the broad message is you know, solidarity.
Heather Stewart, thanks very much, and thanks as well to Damian Collins, Carol Cadwallader, Alex Hearn and Steve Howell. But that's all we have time for this week, and that's all I have time for now. I'm off for a bit of maternity leave and will leave you in the capable hands of my colleagues. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.